16th. It's celebrated worldwide in honor of James Joyce, and we're observing it today with a brief reading from the first chapter, first episode of Ulysses. Just to kind of give you a little background, it might have been a while since you read the novel. It's set in Dublin, takes place during the course of one day on June 16th, 1904. The main protagonist is Leopold Bloom, a Jew, an outsider, residing in the anti-Semitic and Catholic culture. He does not appear until the fourth episode, so you won't hear from him today, but we'll just be reading the excerpt, which involves Malachi Mulligan and Stephen Dedalus and an Englishman who's sharing a room with them in the tower called Martello Tower that overlooks the sea. The time is 8 a.m. Buck Mulligan, a young, opinionated, theatrically inclined medical student, calls Stephen Dedalus, a young writer who you probably remember from Portrait of an Artist, up to the roof of the Sandy Cove Martello Tower where they both live. There's tension between Stephen and Mulligan, stemming from a cruel remark Stephen has overheard Mulligan making about his recently deceased mother, May Dedalus, and from the fact that Mulligan has invited an English student, Haynes, to stay with them. Our readers today, doing Malachi Mulligan, is Kathy O'Brennan. Mary Jean Lord will be reading the part of the narrator. Rick Fry is our Stephen Dedalus, and I do bit parts. My name is Corey Everhart. And we're ready to begin.
Stephen stood up and went over to the parapet. Leaning on it, he looked down on the water and on the mailboat clearing the harbor mouth of Kingston.
Our mighty mother,
Buck Mulligan said. He turned abruptly his gray, searching eyes from the sea to Stephen's face.
The aunt thinks you killed your mother. That's why she won't let me have anything to do with you.
Someone killed her.
You could have knelt down, damn it, Kinch, when your dying mother asked you. I'm Hyperborean as much as you, but to think of your mother begging you with her last breath to kneel down and pray for her, and you refused. There is something sinister in you.
He broke off and lathered again lightly his farther cheek. A tolerant smile curled his lips.
But a lovely mummer. Kinch, the loveliest mummer of them all.
He shaved evenly and with care, in silence, seriously. Stephen, an elbow rested on the jagged granite, leaned his palm against his brow and gazed at the fraying edge of his shiny black coat sleeve. Pain, that was not yet the pain of love, fretted his heart. Silently, in a dream, she had come to him after her death, her wasted body within its loose brown grave clothes, giving off an odor of wax and rosewood. Her breath that had bent upon him mute, reproachful, a faint odor of wetted ashes. Across the threadbare cup edge, he saw the sea hailed as a great sweet mother by the well-fed voice beside him. The ring of bay and skyline held a dull green mass of liquid. A bowl of white china had stood beside her deathbed, holding the green sluggish bile which she had torn up from her rotting liver by fits of loud groaning vomiting. Buck Mulligan wiped again his razor blade.
Ah, poor dogs, buddy. I must give you a shirt and a few nose rags. How are the second-hand breeks?
They fit well enough.
Buck Mulligan attacked the hollow beneath his underlip.
The mockery of it. Second leg, they should be. God knows what poxy bowsy left them off. I have a lovely pair with a hair stripe. Gray. You look spiffing in them. I'm not joking, Kinch. You look damn well when you're dressed.
Thanks. I can't wear them if they're gray.
You can't wear them.
Buck Mulligan told his face in the mirror.
Etiquette is etiquette. He kills his mother, but he can't wear gray trousers.
He folded his razor neatly, and with stroking palps of fingers, felt the smooth skin. Stephen turned his gaze from the sea and to the plump face with its smoke-blue mobile eyes.
That fellow I was with in the ship last night says you have GPI. He's up in Dottieville with Connolly Norman. General paralysis of the insane.
He swept the mirror a half circle in the air to flash the tidings abroad in sunlight now radiant on the sea. His curling, shaven lips laughed and the edges of his white, glittering teeth. Laughter seized all his strong, well-knit trunk.
Look at yourself, you dreadful bard.
Stephen bent forward and peered at the mirror held out to him, cleft by a crooked crack, hair on end.
As he and others see me, who chose this face for me, this dog's body to rid of vermin? It asks me to.
I pinched it out of the skivvy's room. It does her all right. The aunt always keeps plain-looking servants from Malachi. Lead him not into temptation. And her name is Ursula.
Laughing again, he brought the mirror away from Stephen's peering eyes.
The rage of Caliban at not seeing his face in a mirror. If Wilde were only alive to see you.
Drawing back and pointing, Stephen said with bitterness,
it is a symbol of Irish honor, the cracked looking glass of a servant.
Buck Mulligan suddenly linked his arm in Stephen's and walked with him round the tower, his razor and mirror clacking in the pocket where he had thrust them.
It's not fair to tease you like that, Kinch, is it? God knows you have more spirit than any of them.
Harried again, he fears the lancet of my art as I fear that of his, the cold steel pen.
Cracked looking glass of a servant. Tell that to the oxy chap downstairs and touch him for a guinea. He's stinking with money and thinks you're not a gentleman. His old fellow made his tin by selling jalap to Zulus or some bloody swindle or other. God, Kinch, if you and I could only work together, we might do something for the island. Hellenize it.
Cranley's arm, his arm.
And to think of your having to beg from these swine. I'm the only one that knows what you are. Why don't you trust me more? What have you up your nose against me? Is it Haynes? If he makes any more noise here, I'll bring down Seymour, and we'll give him a ragging worse than they gave Clive Kempthorpe.
Young shouts of moneyed voices in Clive Kempthorpe's rooms. Pale faces, they hold their ribs with laughter, one clasping another.
Oh, I shall expire.
Break the news to her gently, Aubrey.
I shall die.
With slit ribbons of his shirt whipping the air, he hops and hobbles around the table, with trousers down at heels, chased by aides of Magdalen, with tailor's shears, a scared calf's face gilded with marmalade.
I don't want to be debagged.
Don't you play the giddy ox with me.
Shouts from the open window, startling evening in the quadrangle. A deaf gardener, apron, masked with Matthew Arnold's face, pushes his mower on the somber lawn, watching narrowly the dancing motes of grasshoms.
To ourselves, new paganism, omphalos. Let him stay. There is nothing wrong with him except at night.
Then what is it? Cough it up. I'm quite frank with you. What have you against me now?
They halted, looking towards the blunt cape of Greyhead that lay on the water like the snout of a sleeping whale. Stephen freed his arm quietly.
Do you wish me to tell you?
Yes, what is it? I don't remember anything.
He looked in Stephen's face as he spoke. A light wind passed his brow, fanning softly his fair, uncombed hair and stirring silver points of anxiety in his eyes. Stephen, depressed by his own voice, said,
do you remember the first day I went to your house after my mother's death?
Buck Mulligan frowned quickly and said,
what? Where? I can't remember anything. I remember only ideas and sensations. Why? What happened in the name of God?
You were making tea and went across the landing to get more hot water. Your mother and some visitor came out of the drawing room. She asked you who was in your room.
Yes? What did I say? I forget.
You said, oh, it's only Daedalus whose mother is beastly dead.
A flush which made him seem younger and more engaging rose to Buck Mulligan's cheek.
Did I say that? Well, what harm is that?
He shook his constraint from him nervously.
And what is death, your mother's or yours or my own? You saw only your mother die. I see them pop off every day in the Mater in Richmond and cut up into tripes in the dissecting room. It's a beastly thing and nothing else. It simply doesn't matter. You wouldn't kneel down to pray for your mother on her deathboat bed when she asked you. Why? Because you have the cursed Jesuit strain in you, only it's injected the wrong way. To me, it's all a mockery and beastly. Her cerebral lobes are not functioning. She calls the doctor, Sir Peter Tazel, and picks buttercups off the quilt. Humor her till it's over. You crossed your last wish in death, and yet you sulk with me because I don't whinge like some hired mute from L'Alouette's. Absurd. I suppose I did say it. I didn't mean to offend the memory of your mother.
He had spoken himself into boldness. Stephen, shielding the gaping wounds which the words had left in his heart, said very coldly,
I am not thinking of the offense to my mother.
Of what then?
Buck Mulligan asked.
Of the offense to me.
Buck Mulligan swung round on his heel.
Oh, an impossible person,
he exclaimed. He walked off quickly round the parapet. Stephen stood at his post, gazing over the calm sea towards the headland. Sea and headland now grew dim. Pulses were beating in his eyes, veiling their sight, and he felt the fever of his cheeks. A voice within the tower called loudly.
Are you up there, Mulligan?
I'm coming.
Buck Mulligan turned towards Stephen and said,
Look at the sea. What does it care about offenses? Chuck Loyola, Kinch, and come on down. The Sassenach wants his morning rashers.
His head halted again for a moment at the top of the staircase, level with the roof.
Don't mope over it all day. I'm inconsequent. Give up the moody brooding.
His head vanished, but the drone of his descending voice boomed out of the stairhead.
And no more turn aside and brood upon love's bitter mystery, for Fergus rules the brazen cars.
Wood shadows floated silently by through the morning peace from the stairhead seaward where he gazed. Inshore and farther out, the mirror of water whitened, spurned by light-shod hurrying feet, white breasts of the dim sea, the twining stresses two by two, a hand plucking the harp strings, merging their twining cords, wave-white wedded words shimmering on the dim tide. A cloud began to cover the sun slowly, wholly, shadowing the bay in deeper green. It lay beneath him, a bowl of bitter waters.
Fergus' song. I sang it alone in the house, holding down the long, dark cords. Her door was open. She wanted to hear my music. Silent, with awe and pity, I went to her bedside. She was crying in her wretched bed. For those words, Stephen, love's bitter mystery, where now? For secrets, old feather fans, tasseled dance cards powdered with musk, a god of amber beads in her locked drawer. A birdcage hung in the sunny window of her house when she was a girl. She heard old Roy singing in the pantomime of Turco the Terrible and laughed with others when he sang, I am the boy that can enjoy invisibility. Phantasmal mirth folded away, musk perfumed, and no more turn aside and brood.
Folded away in the memory of nature with her toys. Memories beset his brooding brain, her glass of water from the kitchen tap when she had approached the sacrament, a cored apple filled with brown sugar roasting for her at the hob on the dark autumn evening, her shapely fingernails reddened by the blood of squashed lice from the children's shirts. In a dream, silently, she had come to him, her wasted body within its loose grave clothes, giving off an odor of wax and rosewood, her breath bent over him with mute, secret words, a faint odor of wetted ashes.
Her glazing eyes, staring out of death, to shake and bend my soul, on me alone, the ghost candle to light her agony, ghostly light on the tortured face, her hoarse, loud breath rattling in horror while all prayed on their knees, her eyes on me to strike me down, Liliata rutilantium te confessorum terma circumdet, illuviantium te virginum chorus excipient.
Ghoul, chewer of corpses.
No, mother, let me be and let me live.